Can someone who's on the other side tell me whether the camera is working?
Yes?
Okay, excellent. We are at the start of Perek Gimel, the start of chapter 3. If you're using the stone Tanakh, we are at the bottom of page 1622, 1623. I am not going to ask for a show of hands of those who actually did read ahead, only to tell you that whoever did read ahead, I appreciate it. And I think it'll help us in terms of understanding what we're doing, especially as we need to accelerate a little bit in order to finish Eov this year. Yeah. Because next year we have to do Kohelet. No. So this chapter has three parts. You can break it up in different ways. I'm breaking it up into three parts. The first part is sentences 1 to 9. The second part is sentences 10 to 19. And then the third part is sentences 20 to 26. Remember what happened before this, okay? We know about his wife and her message to him. We know about his friends, whatever we want to call them, showing up and having nothing to say. They perform actions that indicate grief and mourning. They're there for 7 days and 7 nights, and they have nothing to say. And now, Job, for the first time, is going to say something that is harsh. We've seen two lines from him before this, which were not harsh, right? One saying God has a right to do whatever he does, it's all his, and so on. Then second line, which we said was perhaps slightly less faithful, saying that we have to accept whatever happens, good or bad, indicating there is bad that happens. And now we get to a much longer piece from Eov, from Job. It is the classic chapter in which he curses the day he was born and says that he wishes that he was dead. And then his friends are going to respond to it, and off we go with the rest of the book. So this parak, this chapter, is clearly a very critical chapter in establishing what's going to happen for the rest of the Sefer, for the rest of the book. They're thinking about this before we see it. A simple read of the chapter simply says this is a lament. Okay, a lament in the sense that he is upset, he has been suffering, and he is complaining about his suffering. And he says, especially in the first ten verses, that he wishes he had never been born. He talks about how death is better than life. Interestingly, if you take a look in your Tanakh, I gave you a source as source number one. If you look that up, Jeremiah chapter 20. In the stone Tanakh, you will find it on page 1118. Orient yourselves in Tanakh. It's very worthwhile. It helps you find pages faster. There are other values, too. There are other benefits. Chapter 20, sentences 14 to 18. It is page 1118. Okay. 564 in the Koran one. Okay, good. So what you get here is Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, complaining about his suffering. And look at what he says. Arur hayom asher yuladati bo. He said, cursed is the day on which I was born. Yom asher yiladasni imi al yihi baruch. The day that my mother birthed me should not be blessed. And he goes on, Arur ha'ish asher bisares avi lemor yulad lecha bein zachar. He said, cursed is the one who informed my father that he had a baby boy. I guess in those days also, they didn't allow the fathers in the room. It wasn't just the 1950s. The Sameach simchahu, he who made my father glad. V'ayah ha'ishahu ke'arim asher afach Hashem v'lo nicham, that person should be like cities that God has overturned, and so on. And Lama, he concludes, Lama zeh me'recham yatzasi, why did I leave the womb? Lir'os amal v'yagon, to see struggle, to see misery. That is before, you know, before Job, when we talked about the three different possibilities for the eras in which this was written down, whichever one we adopted, well, except maybe the first one overlapped with Yirmiyahu, but the other two, between the two temples or after, in the beginning of the second temple, certainly were later than this. But it's this idea of cursing the day one is born is not unique to Iyov. It's not unique to Job. I read a paper, which I'm going to quote later. I'm going to end up quoting it in source number 11 by a writer, Karen Langton. It's called Job's Attempt to Regain Control. There's actually a longer title to it, which I'll get to. But she notes that there's a weakness in calling this chapter a lament. Characteristic of a lament in Tanakh is, number one, calling to God for help. We will not see him call to God for help in this chapter. Number two is a lament generally has a complaint about a particular enemy. Someone is doing something bad to me. You will not see that here either. He's miserable. But he does not talk about who is causing him harm. Why do you think this chapter would be lacking those two things? Number one, a cry to God for help, and number two, a complaint against a particular enemy. Yeah, who is it coming from? Coming from God. It's a little useless for you to cry out to God when you think God is the one who's doing this to you, and you're not going to cry out against your enemy when God is the one who is, in fact, causing all of this to happen. So there could be reason for him not doing what people normally do when they lament. Nonetheless, there are two other reads that I want to present for this chapter. One is from Ralbag. Ralbag in general, and I've said this before, takes this chapter as a philosophical statement, much as he takes the whole book as a philosophical statement. Take a look, please, at source number 2 on your sheets. You'll see what I mean. When you read Ralbag on Iyov, what he does is he goes through the chapter first just explaining words and minimally explaining ideas in sentences. And then at the end of the chapter, he gives you klal ha'oleme ha'devarim, here is what comes out of everything, and then he'll trace back through the chapter, showing how the philosophical idea that's supposed to be embedded there actually plays out. So he's first giving you words, and then he's giving you ideas. So take a look at source number 2, which is the beginning of his summary of this chapter. He says, Da'at Iyov haya, Iyov's view was, Shekol mikrei ha'adam hem misudarim umugbalim lafi ma'arechet ha'kochavim be'et ha'leida. That everything a person experiences is ordered, is bounded, has boundaries set based on the arrangement of the stars at the time that the person is born. That's what Job has come to believe. Not what he believed necessarily in the first two chapters, but having suffered in a way that doesn't fit his actions at all, he hasn't decided that there is no God, because he's going to spend the whole book talking to someone who he thinks exists. He hasn't decided there's no God, but he's decided that whatever happens in this world is being orchestrated by somebody other than God. God has outsourced the running of the universe to the stars. Diane?
What's his protest?
Who's Ralbag's? The entire chapter. Like beginning to end, he sees it in everything. We're going to walk through the chapter, and you'll have a chance to see it. But to his mind, the whole chapter, and specifically cursing the day he was born and the night on which he was conceived, feed into that. What's bothering Ralbag, I believe, and what's bothering many commentators on this, both sort of the traditional ones and the non-traditional ones, is it is absolutely and utterly meaningless for a person to curse the day they were born. It's too late. They're there. They can't unbirth themselves. So it's not a curse in the sense of abracadabra, something is going to happen as a result. So my default would be to say that means it's a lament. But again, as we said in the beginning, it doesn't really fit the usual type of a lament. And so Ralbag says, It's neither a curse meant to achieve an end, nor is it simply a complaint of, I am miserable. It's a philosophical statement about the day he was born. That everything that was going to happen to him from that moment in time was set. Because of the way the stars were when he was born, this was always going to happen to him. It's almost as though, I suppose you could say, it's like a lament, and his enemy is the day he was born. Because that was what predisposed him to all these things. Rita?
Don't we believe that everything that comes from God, like, and Satan just wanted God's instrument?
Well, yeah.
When things happen, we do cry out to God. We do lament.
So this is a book that's exploring a different idea right now, right? In other words, I agree with you personally, more or less, with some nuances, but that's not where Job is right now. Job is, as Ralbach reads him, and remember, this is one interpretation of many, but as Ralbach reads Job, that's going to be Job's line throughout the book. He is going to argue that everything that happens is predestined based on the constellations.
Job is going to argue that?
Yes, as Ralbach reads him. Susan?
Is that a prevailing view of those days?
So, right, so,
a unique idea, right?
Well, the big question is, what are in those days? In those days, given that we don't know when or if Job lived, right, is a little tricky. However, if you go back to Greek philosophy, and you're talking about 2nd, 3rd, 4th century Common Era, and move your way forward all the way to the time of Ralbag, where we're talking 14th century, in the Arabic schools of those days, you definitely have a very strong view that believes in astrology. Not everybody agreed with it in the secular world and in the Jewish world. Rambam is famous for not buying into it. But astrology made a lot of sense in that there are forces in this world that we don't understand that are able to do things. I can believe in God and believe that God set up this universe and set up certain powers that are going to be caused by this planet when it's in conjunction with that planet or whatever it is. In the same way that I currently believe that there's this thing called a force of gravity and there is string theory and there is whatever, you know, all the different elements of physics that assign powers to different things that were ultimately created. That's their physics. Is the alignment of planets and constellations and stars. So, yes, this was certainly an idea that existed. Ralbag is quite familiar with it. One of the classic questions when you read Ralbag is, does he believe that... Well, the way Ralbag does this in throughout the book is that he's going to assign philosophical ideas to each of the players. To Eliphaz, to Tzofar, to Bildad. He's going to assign them all philosophical positions. And you sort of wonder as you read it, is that just him putting this in there, or does he really believe that when the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, when the Great Assembly approved this book, they felt that these were being expressed by the different people and that they viewed this book as a response to those philosophical ideas? And that's an open question. I'm not sure of the answer to it. Ralph?
You've answered it, really. You can say what you want about the stars, but they're there because God placed them there in that particular formation. And it's just an excuse, another way of
right.
dealing with it.
Yeah.
Even Sarah and Abraham, right? They changed their name and they added the Sarai was for the Yod and Sarai was not able to have children, and then because her name was changed, Abraham's name was changed, they sort of were under a different mazel.
So there are those who read it that way.
Pre-Eo, so yeah. He couldn't think that you can go above your mazel.
Right. There are those who read it that way. You don't have to read the Psukim at the end of Lach Lecha that way. In other words,
there is that idea. that.
Yes, no, that's true. I mean, and you have more explicit mentions than that. When Hashem says to Avram at the Bris Ben Absarim, at the covenant, he says, you know, he tells him, you know, say min, the Medrash says it as, say min hayis tagninus shelcha. Right? When he tells him go out and count the stars, he says leave your astrology behind, it doesn't apply to you. So, yes, in Medrash you definitely have this this idea.
Just a comment. This is not an unusual response saying I wish I had never been born. A lot of people who I've spoken to, they say that.
Mm-hmm. Right, it's certainly not uncommon, and we saw Yirmiyahu do it also. The problem is just that as laments go in biblical text, it doesn't quite fit. It seems stronger than that. But yes, it's a possibility. So take a look at what he does, because we actually left Ralbag hanging. He says, we're at the end of the first line in the Hebrew, we're at the word therefore in the second line in the English, Ulezek Hilel Hayom. For this reason, therefore, he cursed the day, Shenolad Bo, on which he had been born. L'choshvo ki hu haya sibat haraot shekarahu, because he thought that was the cause of all the evils that had befallen him. V'kileh lel ha-herayon, and he cursed the night he was conceived. L'yoto moral echut masha yikrela ubar berechem ve'etze tomei rechem, because the night of his conception dictates, really, the experience of the fetus in the womb, and when it is going to depart from the womb. V'kilel yom ha-leida t'chila. But he cursed, and this is Rabbag dealing with a problem. He cursed the day of his birth first. If you believe that the night that he's referring to is the night of his conception, then chronologically that should be cursed first, not second. But he curses the day before he curses the night. So how do I understand that? So he says the reason why he cursed the day first is because lehiyoto moreh be'atzmut rishona al mikrei ha'adam b'chayav, because that has primary influence on the events of a person's life, the moment of birth. V'kileh leil ha'herayon achar zeh, and after that he cursed the night of his conception. Because that has secondary influence. So that's the way Ralbag is going to read this chapter, is that it's actually Job blaming the day and the night, and it's a philosophical statement about how the universe works. Yeah? So the answer is not yet. My answer is not yet. Hold the thought, though. We have a lot of chapters to go. One other attempt, or one other way to understand this, is put forth by some of the more modern scholars, and I thought it was interesting. And that is that this is actually a curse, an attempt not to curse the day he was born, but an attempt to destroy all that exists. Yeah, he's thinking big. But he's trying to destroy everything that is there. Day and night are not about his birth. It's day and night. The fellow Michael Fishbane, I gave you the reference to his piece in source number 3. You can see part of the heading there. The full heading is Jeremiah 4, 23 to 26 and Job 3, 3 to 13, a recovered use of the creation pattern, which is a long name. If you take a look at the, I'm not sure exactly how to do this because you would need to have seen this text already. So you know what, I'm going to hold off on how this works in our book, in Job. But take a look in your Tanakh at Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah chapter 4, sentences 23 to 26. Page 1080, thank you. This is Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, complaining. We're mourning, really. Page 1080 in the Art Scroll. Okay? So, look at what he says, and look at the language that he uses, starting in sentence 23. Ra'iti et ha'aretz, I have seen the land, v'hinei tohu vavohu. Right? A phrase we remember from creation, right? The land was tohu vavohu, whatever that means. This is a good question. Ve'el ha-shamayim, I look at the shamayim, the heavens, ve'ein oram, and their light is not there. So you have shamayim and aretz, heaven and earth, from day one. Tohu vavohu as well. And then, ra'iti he'harim v'hinei ro'ashim, I see the mountains, and they tremble. These are the mountains, are elements of day three of creation. V'chol ha'gva'ot hitkalkalu, all of the hills are destroyed, they have here crumbled. Ra'iti v'hinei ein ha'adam, there is no man. V'chol of ha'shamayim nadadu, and the birds of the heavens are gone. That's days 5 and 6. And then ra'iti v'hinei ha'karmel ha'midbar v'chol arav nititsu mipnei Hashem mipnei charon apo. The wilderness, the cities, they're all destroyed before God. He takes Fishbane, it takes as a reference to Shabbos, because he sees Shabbos in general as a destructive day. He traces the word Shabbat, he links it to a Babylonian term, sapatu, which is a term for destruction. So, without going into his whole thing, because there's a lot to be said about it, my point is only that he sees here in Yirmiyahu an invocation of the days of creation and their language in the context of destruction and desolation, a reversal of creation. Keeping that in mind, we're going to see our section here. We're going to see that the language that Eov uses in the first half of this chapter is also going to have, per Fishbane, hints to the days of creation, as though the day and night that he is cursing are actually the day and night. Not his day and night, but the day and night. Along similar lines, I brought you a quote, source number 4, from a writer, Leo Perdue. With 7 incantations, and yes, he identifies 7 in this chapter. We're not going to go through trying to show where the 7 are. Job attempts to destroy his arch enemies day and night. Not merely the times associated with his own birth, though they are certainly included, but the very temporal structure which separates and maintains the created order. By the language of curse encapsulating the powers of primordial chaos opposing the cosmos since the beginning, Job engages in a frontal assault on creation. He wants to destroy everything. What Perdue is suggesting, and Fishbane is suggesting, is that this is not simply somebody complaining he's miserable, which was the first way we read it. It's not necessarily a philosophical statement of, I'm cursing the day and night because those were what caused me to suffer now. It's a curse, an attempt to destroy everything that exists. We're going to need to read this in all 3 of these ways as we go through. Yeah?
Are we reading too much into this? Like, are we saying, you know, I'm reading and just think it's his day and night, not necessarily day and night.
Right. So, excuse me. The writers who do this draw on multiple elements, not all of which am I able to bring here in order to support what they're saying, because otherwise we just have to do a class about, you know, what each of the writers says. But Fishbane and Perdue and Karen Langton, who I mentioned earlier, they tend to rely heavily on other texts that are ancient Near East texts that would be contemporary to Eov that they believe fit the same pattern and are doing the same thing. So there's a lot that they're bringing in that excuse me, that we generally hear are not that familiar with that supports it. But at the end of the day, I come back to, you know, the conversation that I think probably every, you know, university English student has at some point with a professor, when the professor takes them through a sonnet or a poem and says, yeah, the poet meant this, and this image means that, and candles mean this, and death means that, and so on. You look at it and you say, come on, you tell me the poet really had that in mind. You have to be able to support your arguments. You know, this isn't sport. This isn't just, well, let me see what I can do with this. But in the event that you can support it, you have something credible to work from. Thank you. So that's the that's what I would say. But we'll see a little bit of it as we go through. Yeah, Ralph.
Is it necessary to universalize this? he's just in the throes of personal despair. Why bring in creation?
So, a couple of things. First, I think that even somebody in the throes of personal despair might well bring in creation. In other words, I don't think that he has to be thinking small, particularly in the context of what he's going to be doing the rest of this book. He's not somebody who's just engrossed in his own suffering and misery. He's clearly bothered philosophically. He's clearly bothered globally. And he's going to express that. So part of it is the context of the rest of the book tells me he's thinking bigger than that. Part of it, though, is the fact that it's here in Tanakh. Meaning, the decision of let's canonize this says this has a broader message than just someone was really angry when his life fell apart. It's something that's meant to tell me broader messages. So that's another reason to universalize it. Yeah?
The fact that it's so poetic and so, as you put, is that an indication that it was very well thought out, very well planned, and this is not so spontaneous, and this is very deliberate, opposed to like the step spontaneous cry out. So he was very clear about what he was not going to say to his friends who were surrounding him. So maybe he really wasn't so much cursing as much as just
eternal. Right. So some read the poetic structure as evidence to support the view that this is in fact a mashal, because people don't talk this way. It doesn't have to mean that it's a mashal, that Eov isn't real and it's just a parable. It could also be that you had this person who was real, who spoke, but that when it was recorded as a book in Tanakh, they gave it style. So there are other ways we could read it.
Is he speaking here to the mourners?
Yeah.
He's not just speaking to himself.
So it appears.
He's not just talking to himself.
They certainly take it as addressing them. You know, it's an open question as to whether there's anybody else there. It sounds like it's just them, although we're going to find out later there's this fellow Elihu, who's also there, but we don't get to him for a long time. You'll forget this conversation by then, probably. But they believe he's talking to them. That's clear. Let's see it. Let's read it and see where we go with this. There's an awful lot to say. Acharechein, chapter 3, sentence 1 in Job. We're back again on page 1623. Acharechein, after this, after the 7 days and nights have passed, after the silence, and remember that when we say something is after something else biblically, that often means cause and effect. Right? We've seen that any number of times. We saw that last year in the Medrash class where event was after event regarding Noah, and it was taken to have been caused by that which came before it. We see it in rabbinic commentary on things like the Akedah, the offering of Yitzchak, over and over again. So after this silence, caused by the silence, Pasach Eov Espihu, Eov opened his mouth, very dramatic. Right? Because I knew he opened his mouth because he's speaking next. Vayikalel es yomo. And he cursed his day. In contrast to his friends who cannot speak, he will speak. And what emerges is a curse. But here's a funny thing. What word would I have expected to see used to describe the curse based on what we've seen in the book until now? Yeah, it should have said Beirech es yomo. Why Kilel? So one answer could be because this isn't about attacking God. We used Bet Reish Chaf, a term meaning blessing, as a euphemism when we were talking about this towards God, because we didn't want to use the word Likalel. That's one possibility. However, Malbim has a different take on the word Kuf Lamed Lamed. If you take a look at source number 5, Malbim writes, Geish hevdel bein mekalel ubein me'arer. Malbim is in a different context. He's not writing about Job right now. It's a separate verse. But he says there's a difference between one term, kuf lamed lamed, that's used for cursing, and another term, aleph resh resh, that's used for cursing. Shaklala hu mitzayin hadibur, v'hu mishtatef im kala. He says kalal indicates speech, as opposed to action, which we'll see. Kuf lamed lamed indicates speech, and it's related to the word kal, to be light. Shu hefech hakavod. Kuf lamed lamed is the opposite of kavod, meaning honor. Rakshe kuf lamed lamed bekefel humoreb bizayon yoter. But using the lamed twice, it's kal more intensely. By adding the lamed, you intensify the word, indicating, as he writes, bizayon yoter, greater disgrace. The aleph resh resh, another word for cursing, mitzayen apiula, that is an action, shesholeach bo geraon, umazik lo bediburo, vuhefech habracha. That's actually to cause harm to something, to harm it with his speech. This is the opposite of blessing. So in other words, he says, kuf lamed lamed, lekalel is the opposite of kavod, aleph resh resh is the opposite of levarech, for the Hebrew speakers. The point for us, and the reason why I bring this, is because it suggests despising something. Kilel et yomo, he despised his day. If you take a look at source number 6, a modern writer, Valerie Pettis, when creation is made senseless, the original design can no longer be taken seriously. I thought that was a very good way to express it. There's disdain for the power of creation that he's going to be expressing here as he curses the day he was born, or the day period. So let's see what he says. Pasuk Bet, sentence 2. Vayan iyo vayomar. And remember, the word vayan does not mean answer. Vayan is to declare. That's what vayan means. So, Vayan Iyov, Job declared. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at source number 7, I brought you Rashi. He renders it as Vayitzak. He cried out. Shekol aniyaha amuraba Torah ina el lashon haramat kol. Because the word ayin nun hey, when it appears in the Torah, is raising one's voice. And he gives you as the source for that, Anu alaviyim, etc., kol ram, when it describes the blessings and curses that the Levites are going to issue to the Jews when they cross into the land of Israel. So it says, v'anu ha-leviim, they're not answering anybody, but they're declaring. We saw this a few years ago, those who were here when we did Zechariah, we saw the word vayan repeatedly used to mean to declare. So, vayan Iyov, Iyov declared, which is interesting actually, come to think of it. You think of somebody grieving, right? Mourning. He's just lost his family. He's sitting there. He's miserable. His skin is ruptured with these boils. He has no solace. He has no peace from his suffering. I don't know that I would have expected a vayan, a kind of, you know, a declaration. This is not a conversation with his friends. This is not like someone whimpering in grief. Well, I didn't expect that either. Remember what we said last week about his wife? Yes. So now he is saying that which his wife had challenged him to do. You know that it's a week later. Husbands don't have that kind of memory. The wife, after a week, may say to him something in response to what he said a week ago. This proves it's a mashal. I don't know. I hear you, though. It's true, you could view this as sort of, okay, I was supposed to say something, here we go, this is what I'm going to say. I hear you.
What do you think?
I would have expected something indicating a more normal speech, like Vayomer. Just like, you know, I... Sorry? Sorry? Oh, that's an interesting play on words. I hadn't thought about that. Inui is suffering and oppression. Interesting. Okay. Yet another layer we can add here. So what does he do with this vayan? What does he say? Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. That's funny. Vayan yo vayamar was a whole sentence. Yovad, well, there was a reason for that. It's an important sentence. He's finally opened his mouth. Yovad yom ivaled bo v'halayla amar hora gover. This is an introductory statement to the curse. He says, the day on which I was born should be destroyed. And the night on which it was declared, a male is conceived. Classic read. Had that day, had that night not happened, I would never have been born. Take a look at source number 8. Rashi says it explicitly. Halavai v'yovada yom sha'yisi asidli v'aleid bo v'azla yisi nolad. I wish that that day that I was supposed to be born had simply not happened. And then I wouldn't have been born. And this is simply the lament. This is the level of reading it that it is a lament. And that's the way Mitzudat David takes it. If you flip the page, source number 9, Rabbi David Altshuler wrote, Hayom asher noladeti bo yehyeh avud. The day I was born should be destroyed. Rotzelomar, meaning, Bechol shana kishiyavo hayom ahu. Every year when that day comes, yiyevo choshech, ad shia avud mimenu shem yom. There should be darkness so that people won't even think of it as day. He's now not saying I should never have been born, but what he's saying is my birthday shouldn't even be a day. People shouldn't think of it even as a day on the calendar. That is his statement, reading it as a lament. Again, you have to remember, we're reading this now on three levels at the same time. Okay, so stick with me. The first level is the lament. Second level is philosophical statement of cursing this day he was born because that was what dictated everything that would happen to him going forward. And then third is what he's actually saying is he's cursing all of creation because of the suffering that he is now experiencing. Yes?
No, it's kind of strange the way you say it because it's very, in a way, proud or self-centered because that day might have been a good day for other people in the world. So,
yes.
Obliterate an entire... First of all, we know it's impossible, so it's not even a thing that you could say would even be. You could say, oh, would that I had never been born, that would have been, but would that a day is obliterated just won't happen.
Right.
So it's kind of like a hubris that he has because it's like, how does he...
Right. So I would say two things. One personal, one philosophical. On the personal level, I think when people are embedded in grief, the rest of the world doesn't exist. When someone is really suffering, they can't understand how things are normal for everybody else. How is it that cars are going by on the road and they don't, no one understands what I am going through? So I think that that's actually, authentic. From a philosophical level, though, if we take it on the philosophical level, then what he's really angry about is not about his own suffering per se. He's angry that there exists a universe in which someone can do everything right, and very carefully so, and yet horrible things can happen, and he's saying this universe shouldn't exist. So I think that that level can't be ignored. And we're going to see that play out. He's going to express that more explicitly later in the book. So let's see this. Reading through it now more quickly. Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. Remember now, we're going to see language reflecting creation. Go ahead.
When you're saying it's not a revelation, he wasn't the first to say this world shouldn't exist. I mean, all the prophets, when they're really mad, have said, look at the Jews, just that tohu bohu that you read from Yirmiyahu, that why is the world existing when there's so many bad people? It's like, you're talking, like he's not the first in the Torah to ever curse the world for being, God did himself first with Noah, and with Lot's Domra Amora, like Mara, but so it's not original. Like it's not the first.
Right, well, that was why I brought you Yirmiyahu before, was to show that others have had this reaction. That's true. Yeah. Well, you could be blamed for agreeing with someone to be wrong, too. The fact that he jumped off, right, doesn't mean you have to. So, in Psukim, Dalet, and Hey, sentences 4 and 5, he curses the day. Look at this. Hayom hahu yihi choshech. That day should be darkness. Al yidreshehu elokam imal. God above should not seek it out. Val tofa alav nehara. Light should not be manifest on it. Nehora in Aramaic. This is a term for light. Yig aluhu choshech vitzal mavet. It should be claimed by darkness and tzalmavet admits of multiple interpretations. You could read it as the shadow of death. Tishkon alav anana, clouds should settle upon it. Yiva'atuhu kimrirei yom. It should be made frightened. There should be terror on that day. The day should be frightened. He's personifying the day. The day has harmed me. The day should suffer. It should be made to suffer. Kimrire yom. Mirire yom is an odd term. Rashi says it refers to demons. We have references in Ketuvim in particular, also in Chumash in a couple of places, to these demonic spirits, whatever they are. Ketev Miriri is one of them, and that's Mirire Yom. Dat Mikra, for their part, renders it as a black cloud. But the point is that he's saying the day itself ought to suffer. But there is this poetic structure to it. He starts Dalet with Yom and he ends Hey with Yom. He has this kind of envelope going here. In general, there's a poetic structure. You're going to see here that between sentence 5 and sentence 6, he's going to use 5 different Hebrew words to refer to darkness. There's poetry here. He's very intense. And here, Fishbane, who was the one who wanted to show the language of Bereshit, the language of creation, sees that in sentence 4 you have elements of day 1 and day 2 of creation. You talk about darkness and light. You talk about the heavens above. And then we move on to sentence 6, where he starts to curse the night. But he spends more time cursing the night than he did the day. Sentences 6 to 9 are going to be about the night. Halayla hahu yikacheyu ofel. That night should be taken by darkness. Al yichad bimei shana. You could translate that in multiple ways. It should not rejoice with the other days of the year, or it should not be unified with the other days of the year. Either translation is legit. B'mispar yirachim al yavo, it should not enter into the number, the count of the months. It's like it should drop out of the calendar. Hine halayla hahu yehi galmud. That night should be galmud. Galmud is a fascinating word. Galmud can mean mournful, but it is also used to refer to somebody who has no family. Vani shechula v'galmuda is, I think, in Eicha. In Lamentations. To be Galmud is to be without family. So he is now Galmud. And he says the night should be. Different form. Al tavo renanavo, it should not have any joy. Yikvuhu orere yom. The ones who curse the day should curse this. Who are these people? Ha'atidim orer Leviathan, the ones who are capable of awakening the Leviathan. The Leviathan is going to figure into this book in multiple ways. This odd big sea creature. But he's saying that there are people out there who are professional cursers. People who curse. Like, think Bilam, right? He says, those people who know how to curse a particular day, they should come curse the day that Job was born. He's calling on them to help him. Yeah.
My translation says those destined to be childless. Again.
Those destined to be childless. Mm-hmm. You know, what's that? But how does it? How do they? Well, no, orer. Oh, you know how they do it. Okay, that's an interesting translation. Orer, probably from Ariri. Ariri in Biblical Hebrew, no, with an ayin, is a reference to somebody who has no children. They talk about karet v'ariri. And then Leviathan, they'll take, like, levaya, to be escorted. So they don't have anyone to escort them. I don't know where they got it from. Generally speaking, Judaica Press will be quoting some Rishon, you know, a Rashi or a Ramban somewhere, but I haven't seen that as an explanation here. What I presume bothers them is simply that Leviathan just showed up in this chapter in the middle of nowhere. He's going to have no role to play beyond it. So it's kind of odd to see him just thrown in here. Nonetheless, if that is sort of a trait of those who curse, that they claim to be able to rouse the Leviathan, then it makes a lot of sense. That's what he's describing here.
So the funeral thing, it says here that Rashi and Ibn Ezra refer to the passage of the Palestinian Talmud, which relates to wailing women at funerals. A woman should not stir up her funeral bag, and that's what they say is Leviathan, to wail during the intermediate days of the festival.
So they say that Leviathan is the fuel band, and they take it from the...
Right, but that wouldn't work for the O'Rear part.
No, I'm just saying.
That was said, but okay. So it's another way to render it. I will tell you, I am not bringing every possible explanation on every puzzle, because otherwise we will spend the year on chapter 3.
Do we believe that there are people who anchor, like have just
that's a classic question. It appears... is that a Jewish idea, that someone could actually curse like this?
Show president, yes.
I'm not going to repeat that. You're getting in trouble. You have members here. The answer that I would give is that we have this idea that goes back to the story of Bilam, and even earlier to Abraham's time, that people are able to call upon God to cause harm, and if there is sin there, if there's defect there, then God may be moved to act on it. With always the caveat that you should be very careful, because when you call on the judge to judge, you end up being first on the dock. It's not necessarily a wise idea. But there is such a concept, yes. Okay. So what we've seen here is a curse of day and of night. We're on the last sentence on the night. This is a fascinating sentence. The previous sentences all involve two clauses. Here he brings three. Yechshechu kochvei nishpo. The stars of its dusk. Neshef is a term used in the Gemara and Brachos to talk about dusk. The stars of dusk should darken. Yikav leor. It should long for light. Va'ayin, but there will be none. Va'al yir'eh be'af apei shachar. And it should not see the first light of the dawn. He's moving through the night. You're the beginning of the night, the stars that emerge in the beginning of the night. In the middle of the night, they should long for light, and there is none. And it shouldn't see the dawn. It shouldn't see the first light. But he's talking about the night itself as an entity, as though it's a being. So he's done now with his cursing of the day and the night. I'm not going to go through everything that Fishbane does to track language of creation here, because I want to move to the second part of the chapter, in which he says he would prefer death. Starting with Pasuk Yud, sentence 10. Ki lo sagar dalte vitni vayastera malma einai. He says, why am I cursing the night? Because it didn't close the doors of my womb. Note the possessive. I'm going to come back to that. The doors of my belly, the belly from which I emerged. Vayaster amal me'enai. Had he done that, he would have hidden struggle from my eyes. The word amal, like in Kohelet, is used to refer to painful, exhausting, and worthless struggle. He says, if I just remained inside, I wouldn't have been exposed to this. Lama lo me'rechem amut. He says, why didn't I just die there from the womb? Mibeten yatsasi ve'egva, or at least I would have come out of the womb and then breathed my last. Madua kidmuni birkayim, umashadayim ki inak. He says, why was it that I was produced from the womb? Why is it that I was able to nurse? Why was I moved, forward in life? He's progressing. He's gone from being in utero to being born to being nursed. Because frankly, he says, I would have been more at peace. I would have laid down. I would have been silent. I would have slept. There again, you see a progression. Shachavti, eshkot, yashanti. Lie down, be silent, sleep. And then, yanuachli, that I would have been able to rest. I wouldn't have had to deal with all of the suffering that I have. And then he talks about the wonders of being in the womb. He says, Pasuk Yudalad, Im melachim v'yoetzei aretz, habonim charavos lamo. He says, I have pretty good company there. Along with kings, along with the counselors of the land, the people who build up ruins, which you could render in two ways, right? Either they build up ruins to be monuments, or they build things that will become ruins, right? Thus spake Zarathustra, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. The idea that everything ultimately leads to ruin. They build up things that are just going to become ruins. And then in Pasuk Tet Vav, he does something which you have to watch for if you're a Hebrew reader, because they'll throw you off. The word O, we usually take the word O to mean or. Here it doesn't. Here it means also. Is that how they translate it?
No.
They translate it as or. Yeah, so it's also. Watch this. You'll see why. Yeah.
Every time I read this poetry, he's talking about Sheol. And do we have Sheol actually mentioned anywhere in the Bible?
Oh, yeah. No, Sheol shows up in Tanakh. Absolutely. When Yaakov thinks that Yosef is dead, he says, Ered el b'ni avel Sheola. Yeah.
So they're using it. They're assuming that that's where Job wants to go.
Yes. Yes. So he says here, in the womb, I'm with kings and counselors. Oim sarim zahav lahem. You can render it as an or if you like, but it's really an also. With the officers who have all their gold, hamalim batayem kasef, who fill their houses with silver. Ochen nefel tamun lo ehyek olalim lo ra'uor. And he says there, I would be like a nefel. A nefel is a child who is not viable. They, like a Nephel, buried away, not even like that, because I wouldn't have emerged. Ka'olalim, lo'ra'u or, like infants who have not yet seen light. Sham Rishaim Chadlu Roges, there, in this place where you have the kings and the counselors and all that, there, the wicked can't do anything. Roges is a term for anger. But it's a term for the violence that they do. Nothing's happening there. And then you get, yet again, an example of Eov showing up in our liturgy. V'sham yanuchu yigi echawach. You will never sing Yom Shabbaton the same way again. Recognizing these words as coming from this lament. It's a horrible thing to include in a Shabbos song. What in the world is it doing there? But he says, V'sham yanuchu yigi echawach. There, those who are tired will rest. It is a place of peace. Yachad asirim sha'ananu. There, those who are imprisoned, who are chained, will rest. Lo shamu kol noges. They will not hear the oppressor. Katon v'gadol shamhu. Small and great are both there. Ve'eved chavshime adonav. And the slave is free of his master. Lama yitain la'amel or v'chayim la'mare nafesh. Why does God give the one who struggles light? Why does he bring? Why did he take? I'm sorry. He's actually starting the next section here. So, his previous section, he said death would be better. The womb is a peaceful place. Why in the world was I dragged out to have to experience this? And then his last section in this chapter, he shifts to say, why isn't God going to let me go? Fine, I had to be born. He took me out of the womb. He made sure I survived this long. But at least now, God, let me go. He says, Lama yitain la'amel or v'chayim la'mare nafesh. Bless you. Why does God give light and life to people of bitter spirit? Hamechakim lamaves ve'enenu. They wait for death and it's not there. V'yachfaruhu mimat monim. They search for it more than they search for buried treasure. Hasmechim elei gil yasisu kiyimtzu kaver. He says, people who rejoice, people who have great satisfaction, they will be happy when? When they find a grave. And here there's this great irony. This is fantastic. He says, to the man whose path was Nistara. How do they translate Nistara in yours? Sorry? Hidden?
Hidden.
Okay. I wondered about this because you could also use it to mean destroyed. So his path was destroyed. But taking it as concealed, the way to read the line would be, the man whose path was hidden, as in he doesn't know how to get out. He doesn't know what his path ought to be. Vayasech elokah ba'ado, and God covered up for him. Do you remember that word, vayasech? Yes, chach. But where did we see that word before? I didn't notice it either, so don't feel bad. Valerie Pettis, in her article, is the one who notes it. Take a look back in chapter 1, sentence 10. Satan used that word. He turned to God and said, of course Job reveres you. Hello, atasachta ba'ado. He says, you protected him. Sorry? Same word. The sin and the samach interchange. It is the exact same word. They don't get caught up in that. The vayasech eloka ba'ado, in a bad way now, that which Satan said God does, he shields you for the good. Job says, I don't want to be shielded. I'd like to leave this world now. He says, this vayasech is not helping me. There's a great irony in that. And then you get to the height of his complaint. Pasuk Chav Dalet, 10:24. Ki lifnei lachmi an chasi tavo. He says, before my bread, I sigh. When I come to eat, I moan. Vayitchu kamayim shago sai. My cries flow like water. Ki fachad pachadati vayeh sayeni. Because all my life, I was afraid. I brought it for you in source number 10, but I'm racing a little bit now. Rashi said it there. All my life, I was afraid that something terrible was going to happen, that my kids were going to sin, and that as a result we would be punished. All my life I was afraid of this. Vasher yagorti yavoli, and that which I feared has in fact come to pass. Lo shalavti velo shakatiti velo nachti, I never had rest. He expressed it in three ways. Vayavo roges, and now instead this anger and this violence has come upon me. So Job has, again, three levels here. A lament, possibly a philosophical statement per Ralbag about the stars being responsible for his existence, which we have to explore more through the book, or a curse attempting to destroy all that exists, along with his day and night. And we've seen it play out in terms of his preference for death, wishing he was still in the womb, and so on, and asking, why won't God let him die? One last thought on this section very briefly. Take a look at source number 11. I mentioned her before, Karen Langton. Her article, the full title is Job's Attempt to Regain Control, Traces of a Babylonian Birth Incantation in Job 3. Wow. They pay by the word for the title anyway. One of the points that she makes, leave aside the Babylonian birth incantation, that's interesting, but not to the point. One of the points she makes is that Job wants to assert control. People who suffer, one of the worst parts of suffering is the lack of control, the inability to change one's situation and prevent things. Notice his possessive language. Kilel et yomo, he cursed his day. He talked about the womb as bitni, my womb. He wants to assert control. It's obvious that wishing to reverse one's birth is impossible, right? But he's desperate to control something. That's what he wants throughout the book. And so what she does here is she shows that the Jews of that time would have been familiar with birth incantations, which people did in order to have a good birth, and that the language that he uses in this chapter actually reverses those incantations, as though he's saying, I don't want to have been born. This should not have been used for me. And it's a case of the author of Sefer Iyov using language the Jews would be familiar with, but that today, unless you're an archaeologist, you wouldn't have any clue reading this, what's actually happening. Take a look at source number 11, and that will conclude it. I suggest the author is using Job's incantation to ridicule the idea that humanity, in this case Job, could think he was in control. Job utters the birth incantation to gain control, not to destroy. But his incantation is an impossible spell. What she sees here in this chapter is a little bit of a Musar lesson, a little bit of a rebuke to the reader. Because you look at Job, and it looks ridiculous that somebody would think he could exercise control to the point where he could reverse his birth. But we do things like this all the time, where we try to assert control over things that are beyond our control. When we're angry about something, when we're upset about something, I'm going to change this, I'm going to make this different. Look in the mirror and see Eov, see Job, and what he's trying to do here. That's what it's meant to show you, is the state of this person who is suffering and what he ends up doing. There's much more to say on all of this. I'm going to stop here, and next time try to start with Eliphaz in chapter 4. If you want to follow up with me, just one second. If you want to follow up with me by email between sessions, I am more than glad. I know we can't discuss everything. I just want to be able for us to see this book as a whole this year. Thank you.